3-week residency. Numerous politicians had made a point of coming to Cabrini, usually to add grist to whatever housing or welfare reforms they were pushing. At 1230 North Burling, Dolores Wilson regularly toured congressmen and senators. She met Jack Kemp so many times, she said, that she was willing to switch over to the Republicans if it meant sending him to the White House. "I don't care what Jesse Jackson or anyone else says," Dolores would say. "I'm voting for Kemp because I know what he's for." Keller was happy to play host to Shays. Fair-skinned and straight-haired, Queso was raised by adoptive parents who were white, and at various times he lived as a white person, a black person, and a Latino. For these reasons, he thought of himself as a bridge between cultures, and between Cabrini Green and the outside world. He walked the congressman around the land at Cabrini, introducing him to residents. When Shays seemed eager to see more, Queso asked if he wanted to stay the night. Shays did. He slept on the couch in Queso's living room.
"Honey, it's incredible. I'll tell you about it when I get home," whispered Christopher,
as I overheard him calling home to his wife from an old payphone at the bottom of my building, Keller wrote. The two men spoke late into the night. Shays asked about living conditions and what sorts of jobs people had, and what the worst thing was that Keller had seen. Shays was a Republican who denounced federal control of public housing, a New York University MBA, a Christian Scientist who was still married to his childhood sweetheart. The guy seemed as foreign and inscrutable to Keller as the people at Cabrini must have come across to him. "I wondered what he might have been thinking about us, his stay, future concerns, or if he just wanted to say that he'd spent the night in Cabrini Green," Keller mused. The next morning, Shays thanked Queso for the hospitality. The couch he found comfortable, but he did have to ask about the thick fug of heat in the apartment, the lack of any circulating air. It was unbearable. "How do you guys manage?" The question seemed like a bit of life imitating the art of good times. In an episode of the sitcom, a white official from the housing authority calls on the Evans family and is shocked to find the elevator out of order. He can't catch his breath after hiking the 17 flights of stairs. He learns, too, that the heat isn't working. The refrigerator is broken, and no water is flowing from the taps. "I hate to bring you people down," he says to the amused family, "but it's awfully depressing to hear things like that." Then word reaches the Evans apartment that two gangs are fighting outside the towers, forcing the official to stay for dinner. Outraged to discover that nice people are suffering in these disgraceful conditions, he announces that he is going to bring changes. He's a top administrator at the district office, and he will make it happen. "You have my word. Everything that's wrong in this building is going to be fixed." When the gang fight ends, he hurries out the door, promising over his shoulder that the Evans family should start to see repairs in 13 or 14 months. Keller didn't reply to Shays's question, or at least he said he didn't in the article, which he ends with an oddly revealing combination of conviction and doubt, a silencing of his Cabrini voice. He writes, "I wanted to comment, but I knew inside that he too knew the answer. Didn't he?" Vince Lane returned to Cabrini Green 3 weeks after speaking at Holy Family. On the campus of the nearby Moody Bible Institute, Cabrini residents joined him at an all-day planning summit. Asked to enumerate their concerns, tenants said they worried that they were being tricked off their land. They were allowed to live on the near north side so long as the area was full of crime and poverty. Now, with investment and upkeep, with improved policing and new amenities, they didn't believe that they would be allowed to stay to enjoy it. Lane led 3 more meetings at Cabrini the following month and a town hall for all residents. Did the tenants feel like they were heard? They did. They joined committees and neighborhood advisory councils. They met with an independent facilitator Lane hired to keep the dialogue going. They were convinced that they were included in what the CHA was now calling the rebirth of Cabrini Green through resident empowerment partnership. This first phase of Cabrini Green's development would cover only 9 of the 70 acres, just the northern end of the Cabrini Extension site along Division Street. For more than a year, the residents in the Empowerment Partnership dutifully completed the application for the $50 million HOPE 6 grant. In the days before turning in the application, they traveled by bus to a suburban Hyatt Hotel, 30 minutes outside Chicago. The weekend planning session began with a motivational screening of Fired Up, the documentary that had been made about the 1230 North Burling resident managers. Then, in groups, they hashed out the particulars of how security would operate in the redeveloped section of Cabrini, how the construction could be used to hire residents and support resident-owned businesses. They discussed the ideal blend of public housing and market-rate units in the mixed-income replacement buildings. Tenants wanted the rebuild to include the maximum number of public housing units, and the city argued that there was a threshold at which the neighborhood could lose the stability and diversity it had recently gained. The city hoped the mix in the new buildings would hew closer to a realtor rule of thumb, that white people wouldn't move into any neighborhood that was more than 30% black. The residents wanted guarantees that they could stay in the area, even during construction. The city insisted that it had to support the private developers, who would build the mixed-income housing and take on the risk of selling or renting out a majority of the units. In the end, everyone agreed to the demolition of three towers. In the new buildings replacing them, 40% of the units would be reserved for public housing families. The proposal also earmarked funds for a battery of new and improved social services, for a resident-owned security company, and for job training and other resident businesses. Mayor Daley sent the group a letter in support of their application, and one of the Cabrini leaders called it a marvelous plan. It will better the community and give us pride. Vince Lane didn't have the opportunity to see this marvelous plan come into being. In May 1995, HUD seized control of the CHA, forcing out Lane as part of a federal takeover of the agency. The CHA had long been a stalwart of dysfunction, remaining on HUD's Troubled Housing Authority list since the designation began in 1978. In its most recent evaluation, the CHA managed a score of just 50 out of 100. New York City, with 180,000 units of public housing, scored in the 90s. HUD saw that Lane had spent $74 million on sweeps and other security measures over the past year, and still, CHA residents were twice as likely as other Chicagoans to be victims of a serious crime. Employees of the agency were caught in various schemes involving ghost workers, falsified overtime records, and overcharging for supplies. Lane believed he was targeted because Mayor Daley saw him as a political threat. A few years after being ousted from the agency, he was convicted for making false statements on a loan application tied to the development of a Southside shopping center. For the violation, Lane's lawyer said he deserved at most probation, since no one suffered a financial loss. But Lane received a 2.5-year prison sentence. For many, the punishment seemed excessive. Lane certainly thought so. Daley killed me off, period. Cabrini residents adapted, joining with others to evaluate the developers bidding on the redevelopment of the 9-acre site. In the meantime, the city went ahead and tore down 1117 to 1119 North Cleveland, the home of the Castle Crew, the building Brother Bill frequented, and where Dolores Wilson and her family had lived when they came to Cabrini in 1956. The building had stood for 39 years, and it was the first Cabrini green high-rise to be demolished. Its demise was cause for both celebration and reflection, hope and concern. Then, suddenly, Cabrini residents who'd been involved in the redevelopment partnership for 2 years were shut out of meetings. They were told they'd be consulted in due time. Months passed. In June 1996, Mayor Daley made a public announcement about a revised development plan for the neighborhood that differed significantly from the previous one. Flanked by politicians and planners, but notably no Cabrini Green residents, he said 8 Cabrini towers would now be demolished, not 3. The rebuild would be much larger, spreading to other nearby plots of land, and would add 2,300 units of housing in townhomes and three flats, restoring the street grid, and including new schools, a police station, a shopping center, and an expanded park. Just 15% of the units under Daley's proposal would be available to very low-income families, representing a net loss of nearly 1,000 public housing homes. The plan seemed less like the redevelopment of the Cabrini Extension Towers than a public-private push to accelerate gentrification in an area abutting the city center.
"How can they take our roots from us without our input?" Dolores' daughter Cheryl asked. "They're planning to move the poor and destitute and build for rich folks."
5 years earlier, in 1991, residents at the Henry Horner Homes had sued the CHA and HUD, accusing them of de facto demolition, allowing the vacancy rate to reach 50% and conditions to degrade so much that there was nothing left to do but tear down the buildings. In a 1995 settlement, the city was forced into a consent decree that dictated the terms of Horner's redevelopment. At Cabrini, tenants had trusted that their city partners would hold up their side of an agreement. But at Horner, the city was bound by a court order. More than half of the units were reserved for very low-income families. Demolition and construction were staggered, and residents never had to cope with an involuntary relocation. So in 1996, Cabrini tenants sued as well. 22 charges in all, accusing the Daley administration and the CHA of violating the 1968 Fair Housing Act, which made it illegal to use federal money to maintain racial segregation, the Civil Rights Act of 1964, the U.S. Housing Act, the Community Development Block Grant Agreement, and the Hope 6 Statute. To the surprise of city government, a U.S. district judge listened to testimony, and in January 1997 ruled against the CHA's motion to dismiss the lawsuit. 18 of the 22 counts could go forward, and he issued an injunction halting further demolition at Cabrini Green until the case was heard. It was a victory for tenants. "There is a God up above," Cora Moore said. Dolores Wilson. Before the filing of the lawsuit, and even before the rehab of 1230 North Burling was finished, Dolores Wilson decided to step down as president of her building's management corporation. She was 64 in 1993, and tired. She'd been helping run her high-rise for more than a decade, and since Hubert's death, her calendar had been filled from 1 year to the next. When she announced her resignation, Bertha Gilkey persuaded her to stick around a little longer. "Just another month," Gilkey urged, "long enough to see through the repairs of the building's roof." Then a month passed, and Gilkey asked her to wait until other construction contracts were signed. Then she needed Dolores to travel to Washington with her to speak to lawmakers about resident management. Dolores knew she had trouble saying no. Her pastor would ask her to go somewhere, and what could she do? She'd go. Finally, Dolores was allowed to hand off the presidency to one of her neighbors. She left the water department around the same time. The city was offering early retirement, and after 27 years at the job, Dolores took it. The head of microscopy was from Bulgaria, and to Dolores she sounded just like Zsa Zsa Gabor.
"This is your day, Dolores. Stop filing papers. Come here," she said.
She led Dolores to a long table at the department covered with food, and people from all the laboratories came by to wish her farewell. That was a week or two before Michael Jordan's father was killed. For years to come, that's how Dolores would place the date, because she sent the Bulls star a sympathy card, and he sent her a thank you in return. She'd gathered all the children in the Burling building to write condolences as well. She told them not to beg Jordan for anything, just to write that they were very sorry to hear about his daddy. But one of them asked for a bike. The boy used to break the wings off pigeons, and Dolores told his stepfather that children who were allowed to torture little animals would get the feeling of death in them. Eventually, it wouldn't mean anything to the child to cripple or kill a person. That's how Jeffrey Dahmer, the Milwaukee Cannibal got started, she explained. But the boy later became a preacher.
Good things can come out of bad, I guess, Dolores said.
I think at least I saved some animal lives.
Dolores had a harder time recalling exactly when her own Michael, her second child, died.
Some things you just can't.
She tried not to think about his death, but guessed it happened 2 years earlier, maybe in 1991. Mike was almost 40 then, and divorced. He had 4 children, and was also raising his girlfriend's 2 as his own. He was with the girlfriend on a summer night, at a Chicago Avenue sandwich shop by the row houses. He went to buy cigarettes at a gas station on Orleans, and when he returned, a guy who used to date his girlfriend was threatening her, saying he'd bash her head in with a bottle.
One thing about my sons, Dolores would say with a mix of pride and sorrow, they protect their women. They're gallant.
The 2 men came to blows, and Mike ended up on top. That's when one of the ex-boyfriend's associates pulled out a gun and shot Michael in the back, close range, with a hollow-point bullet. It seemed utterly unfair to Dolores. She had dedicated much of her life to the community and the neighborhood children. She'd received service awards from her church and the YMCA. The district police had honored her and Sugar Ray Dinky on the same day. Jack Kemp had personally named her the HUD Resident of the Year.
All that, and look what happened to her own baby.
Michael's children were left fatherless. In her grief, Dolores wanted to be left alone, but the visitors kept coming. She said little in front of them, even joked. But then she'd close herself in the bathroom and scream. Someone had to explain to her what a hollow-point bullet was, how it expanded as it traveled inside the body. Hearing that made her think differently about people. One of the members of her church had a 25-year-old daughter who'd gone missing for 3 months a couple of years earlier. The police refused to look for her, saying, "You sure she's not laid up with someone?" The daughter had been murdered, it turned out. Her body left to decay in a sewer 2 blocks away. The woman had a son as well who'd been shot in the back behind one of the Cabrini high-rises. That mother said to Dolores, "Miss Wilson, you always told me to keep the faith. Now you have to keep the faith." The pastor from Holy Family counseled Dolores, saying she was the most forgiving person he'd ever known. At the funeral service, Dolores stood in front of the congregation and said she didn't want any retaliation. She asked that Michael's friends and other folks from the building pass along that message. She attended the trial, and when the ex-boyfriend was found not guilty, she hugged and kissed his mother, telling her she knew he didn't do the killing. She felt less compassion for the shooter. He was found guilty of second-degree murder and sentenced to 7 years. Dolores' youngest son, Kenny, had broken into a car trunk once and stolen a few tools, and received the same sentence. "There's no justice," she would say. "A gangbanger got 7 years for killing my son, and Kenny got 7 years for stealing a damn screwdriver and wrench." Dolores had been hosting family reunions in Lincoln Park every August for a decade, but she stopped after Michael was murdered. Sometimes she wished her children had moved away, had left Chicago and stayed in Indiana or another place. But she didn't blame Cabrini Green. She didn't imagine her children would have lived a better life elsewhere. A reporter who interviewed her 3 days after Michael's funeral asked her if there was anything she wanted to convey to outsiders about her home. Dolores paused to think. She guessed she did have a message. "Tell them that there's more love over here than terrorizing." 13. If not here, where? Kelvin Cannon. Kelvin Cannon got off the elevator one morning on his way out of the building, and Cora Moore blocked his path. When he was a boy living next door in 714 West Division, Moore often scolded him for fighting with the children in her high-rise. He was now 26, and she still reprimanded him. She was in charge of resident security at 1230 North Burling, and he called it for the gangster disciples there.
"You should get on my team," Cora began that morning in 1989. "Do you want to be out here and be free and raise your family? Then you have to leave gangbanging alone." She'd been delivering the same pitch for a couple of years, trying to recruit him away from the gang. "What I'm offering, they can't offer you. I'm offering you a chance at a better way of life."
Cannon lingered in the lobby longer than usual. He'd been wondering lately whether there were other options available to someone like him, thinking that probably there were none. He'd managed to avoid a return to the penitentiary, but he was tired of the police raids, of going back and forth to jail for weeks at a time. Cora, sensing the opening, told Kelvin that he was smarter than most. She said the building's resident management was getting started, and he could be one of its leaders. He could work right there in the high-rise. Like Bo John had made him believe when he was 13, Moore said he could be part of something bigger than himself. "If you really want to change, help me fix the building," she told him. "Let me show you the other side of life."
"Okay," he said.
"Show me." Cannon went to the leaders of the disciples and said he was resigning his position. Moore talked to the commander at the police precinct and said Cannon was now working under her. She signed him up for a security guard class. In prison, he had read the Bible, first the New Testament and then the Old, and he continued to school himself after his release, looking at a dictionary in his apartment, working on his vocabulary and spelling. But he hadn't been in a classroom since he was kicked out of Cooley High. He completed the security guard program, and in his uniform and cap, he monitored the stairwells and ramps of his high-rise. Some thought it hypocritical that after all Cannon had done, he was telling 8-year-olds to stop fooling around on the elevators and directing young men to move from in front of the building. But he said he'd always been in charge of people at Cabrini Green and giving orders in one form or another. He was only doing more of the same.
"You turned police?" a guy from the building asked him.
"Nah, my brother. I'm trying a new way of life." He was one of the few men to go through the resident management classes with Bertha Gilkey. On the weekend retreats, he sang "We Shall Overcome" with Dolores and everyone else, and he studied budgeting and federal housing regulations. He went along on the trips to see other tenant-managed housing complexes in Boston, D.C., and St. Louis. Like Dolores, he came to know politicians personally. "I haven't forgotten my pledge to be your bridge to HUD in the city of Chicago," the Secretary of Housing wrote in a note, asking about the well-being of Cannon's wife and signing it, "Old Number 15, Jack Kemp, your friend." Moore used her connections to get Cannon into a training course for CHA janitors. He apprenticed at Cabrini Green, shadowing the electricians, carpenters, glazers, and locksmiths. He did masonry and bricklaying, whatever the buildings needed. For 2 years, he took night classes at a trade school. After graduating, he started off at $11 an hour. But when he was put in charge of the janitors in 1230 North Burling as a union worker, his pay jumped to $17,000 a year. That was good money, in all senses. He earned it as a day-in, day-out laboring professional, on call 24 hours a day. He barely left the high-rise, and he'd become more like Hubert Wilson, Dolores' husband, than his old self. He joined a church and trained to be a deacon. Cannon took pride in his high-rise's improvements. "It looked better than any other building in Chicago that was public housing," he'd brag. "You know in that Ajax commercial, they go past certain houses that are all grimy and filthy. Then they come to the one real clean house. It's spotless." The music stops, and a woman says, "Ajax was here." "Well, that was our building, like Ajax had been there."
J.R. Fleming. When J.R. was arrested for selling drugs on the far north side, it was Jesse White who picked up the phone, telling the prosecutor that he vouched for the young man. "Jesse White took me under his wing," J.R. said. As part of the Young Democrats of Cook County, J.R. helped out whenever the ward boss, George Dunn, hosted a community event, or when White needed guys to pass out turkeys or school supplies. In the procession at the annual Bud Billiken parade across the South Side, he carried the banner of the ward organization. And come election time, he hung campaign posters, tore down those of the opposition, and ushered Cabrini residents to the polls. "I was being raised politically," J.R. explained. One time, the pastor at Holy Family asked J.R. if he could get his bosses to fix the sidewalk in front of the church. He brought it up, and the sidewalk was repaved. "It was an awakening," J.R. recalled. "Politics is a means to an end. My power got that done. It felt great." Men ran the ward. Women, for the most part, ran Cabrini Green. Marion Stamps cornered J.R. one day at a neighborhood youth center.
"Don't be a puppet's puppet," she warned him.
"There's always a master pulling both of your strings." She ran again for alderman in 1995, reminding voters that she'd orchestrated the gang truce and railing against the plans to tear down sections of Cabrini Green. She called it a tragedy that revitalization meant moving in white and wealthier residents and moving out the neighborhood's longtime inhabitants. "It's no accident that they pieced together this ward with little pockets of black people that they intend to make disappear. It's all about displacement and reclaiming of the land," she said. "If they come at Cabrini in the daytime, they're going to come after the rest of them at night. And that's not only public housing. That's any housing that's available for poor people." Her chief opponent in the race was J.R.'s immediate supervisor in the ward office, the chairman of the Young Democrats, Walter Burnett, who was a young man in the Cabrini row houses, was an accomplice in a bank robbery, and served some jail time. After his release, Burnett went to work for the ward organization and was mentored by Jesse White before rising through the local patronage system. He had the power brokers on his side. J.R. was one soldier in a small army of campaign workers they commanded. Burnett won easily, and Stamps decided to leave the Cabrini Green area and move back to her hometown of Jackson, Mississippi. Her father was still living there, and she saw a fitting symmetry in attaining political office where her activism began. But at the age of 51, before she packed a single bag, Stamps died of a heart attack in her sleep. "Stress killed her," her daughter Gwana said. About a year after Burnett's election, J.R. decided to get out of politics altogether. He had worked what he called slave hours for six straight days setting up for the 1996 Democratic National Convention. By pulling off the event without a hitch, the second Mayor Daley would simultaneously match his father as political kingmaker, helping launch Bill Clinton's reelection campaign, and surpass him by avoiding the chaos that ensued on the streets and in the convention hall a generation before. 28 years earlier, when Connecticut Senator Abraham Ribicoff used his nominating speech to denounce the Gestapo tactics of the Chicago police then beating up protesters in Lincoln Park, people observing the first Mayor Daley said he yelled, "Fuck you, you Jew son of a bitch! You lousy motherfucker! Go home!" Daley Sr. said he never in his life used such language. "Faker" was what his supporters said he shouted. In 1968, Chicago had used tall fencing to mask the bleakness of the old Stockyard neighborhood surrounding the convention center. The 1996 convention took place in the United Center, the new home of the Bulls and Blackhawks, completed just west of the Loop 2 years earlier, at a cost of $175 million. Daley's vision for the city was inspired by his trips to Paris. Chicago as a post-industrial urban gem, a global city, and a central tourist attraction. Here was an opportunity to showcase the revitalized Chicago he was creating, a city once again on the make.
Several of the Horner high-rises across from the United Center were demolished. The city covered nearby vacant lots with wood chips and newly planted bushes. Owners of parking lots and other properties in the vicinity were pressured to put up wrought iron fencing and planter boxes. Roads were repaved and lined with antique-style street lamps and hanging flower baskets. Bridges were painted. The exteriors of nearby schools restored. Street signs added. And the train running west from the loop over Lake Street reopened. And like in Paris, the office buildings in the loop were lit up at night. When Bill Clinton first ran for president, he presented himself as a new Democrat. He derided the longtime failures of government and pledged to end welfare as we know it, explaining that William Julius Wilson's writing on concentration effects made me see the problems of race and poverty and the inner city in a different light. Running again as a moderate in 1996, angling to win back congressional seats lost 2 years earlier, Clinton touted the welfare reform bill that he'd signed into law only a week before his arrival in Chicago. The federal entitlement now came with work requirements and a lifetime limit of 5 years for any recipient. He sold himself as tough on crime as well. He was putting 100,000 new police officers on the streets and had made 3 strikes and you're out lifetime sentences for habitual offenders the law of the land. The Republican presidential candidate, Bob Dole, referred to public housing on the campaign trail as one of the last bastions of socialism in the world, arguing for its privatization and erasure. Clinton agreed that the program needed to be curtailed, accepting that the demand-side marketplace probably couldn't do worse than the likes of the CHA. Jesse Jackson spoke at the convention, reluctantly, he claimed, saying that Clinton's cuts to the social safety net were a devastating blow to the have-nots. He said new public housing complexes were in fact being built and maintained across the land. They were the federal and state prisons that were home disproportionately to black men. Jackson argued that the Democrats still needed to be the party that fought for the social well-being of all Americans. The idea that there were enough decent-paying jobs out there for anyone with initiative to seize was a fantasy. Citing Martin Luther King, Jr., he said there were mountaintops of prosperity in the center of his city, but much of the rest of Chicago lay in a canyon. Once Campbell's Soup was in this canyon, Sears was there, and Zenith, Sunbeam, the Stockyards. There were jobs and industry where now there is a canyon of welfare and despair. The national economy under Clinton had rebounded, and a seemingly bottomless deficit had been filled. But inequality was deepening and widening. "What is our obligation to the people in the canyon?" Jackson demanded. "That was Roosevelt's dream, and Dr. King's." J.R. never set foot in the United Center during the convention. He spent his days setting up events in downtown hotel rooms where visiting delegates gathered. His hands were calloused from hanging posters, his thumbs bruised from tying balloons. He didn't hear a word Clinton or Jackson said. But J.R. reflexively dismissed the Reverend Jackson as a poverty pimp, looking to advance his own career on the plight of the poor. And as for Clinton, J.R. knew that the president hadn't stood up for midnight basketball, the league he played in at Cabrini Green. Republicans attacked the puny line item in the president's $33 billion crime bill, ridiculing the idea that any tax dollars might be spent on what they deemed as games for criminals and crackheads. Clinton scrapped the program rather than defend it. It didn't matter that the league had been started under President George H.W. Bush, one of his 1,000 points of light, as a way to keep public housing residents engaged in positive activities, or that it was proven to reduce crime. J.R. was done with them all. He told Brother Jim about his decision to quit politics. "I knew you'd figure that one out," Jim said. What J.R. focused on instead was perfecting his peddling business. He bought a red GMC Vandura, and later, when his profits allowed it, a blue one too. Most mornings he parked one of the vans outside a Cabrini Green high-rise, laid on the horn, and then began his rounds. "Tapes, CDs, movies,"
he cried. Tapes, CDs, movies.
J.R. shouldered a military duffel the size of a rowboat. Inside, he placed cardboard runners to partition his wares, like in a case of wine. Old soul and hip-hop in separate compartments, pirated video games and others. From the strap, he dangled plastic bags filled with Bulls t-shirts and caps, with socks and towels. Michael Jordan had given up on baseball, thankfully, and the Bulls were again winning titles. God's gift to the city, and to its street sellers. J.R. was a one-man Chicago Bulls emporium. He wasn't some junk man's operation either, a strung-out barker pushing a stolen grocery cart. He was organized. He had systems. He called his daily rounds rotating on the land, and his rotations covered much of Cabrini Green's 70 acres. J.R. would sell to the guy stationed in front of the building or in the lobby. They wanted the new Nas or Wu-Tang CD, a copy of Space Jam or the Adam Sandler movie that had opened in theaters that weekend, and J.R. had the bootlegs at cut-rate prices. He'd tease them, saying that he earned more in a week than they did, and he was pushing product that at least was kind of legal. Then he climbed the high-rises, going floor to floor. He knew most people at Cabrini Green, at least by nickname, and there were regular customers whose apartments he always hit. Other residents, hearing his shouts, beckoned him to their doors. He knew when the checks for welfare, Social Security, and the city payroll arrived, and he might leave a high-rise with $300 in sales. He'd restock in his Vandura, and then move on to the next building, and then the next one. He went through the whites, the reds, the row houses. He set up shop as well on the floor of J.J. Fish and Chicken, a fast food restaurant on Larrabee, spreading out a mat and covering it with merchandise. The owners accepted the arrangement as a part of doing business in the neighborhood. It added up to a considerable haul. J.R. wasn't exactly the type to report to the IRS. But one year, when he was caught up in a criminal case, his lawyer persuaded him to file a tax return. He listed self-employment earnings of $87,900. He bought new Compaq and Hewlett-Packard computers, investing in software and drivers to make his work copying music and movies easier. He rented his sister Marzetta a place on the south side, so he could turn her Cabrini unit in 1017 North Larrabee into a warehouse and workshop. It wasn't just the money that drove him, though of course he chased that. There was a sport of it, the competition, the compulsion to win. There was another hustler, known as Big Boy for his considerable girth, a family friend who'd given J.R. his start duplicating movies. J.R. took over Big Boy's buildings at Cabrini, undercutting his prices. Willie Sr. had to come back from Alabama to intervene, scolding J.R. for his lack of restraint. Big Boy gotta eat too, son. And still it wasn't enough. On weekends, J.R. rented tables at the Swaparama, the giant flea market that operated on a barren rail yard blocks from the old stockyards. He'd scour the market for goods he might resell back at Cabrini Green, picking up sports jerseys and car sound systems. All those women who did hair out of their apartments, J.R. would buy a case of 24 $1 tubes of gel for $6, offering it for $16 to the lady in 1230 North Burling who specialized in finger waves. For a while, he made a killing at Cabrini reselling bed linens and comforters. Whenever a policeman accused J.R. of piracy, he would rattle off the laws he'd memorized. These goods are protected under the U.S. copyright law, section 117-A-2, which states that it is not an infringement for the owner of a digital file to make another copy if said new copy is used as a backup. Usually, the cop would move on to the next knucklehead who didn't have a defense lined up. On his rounds, J.R. would even drop into the station house in the 365 West Oak high-rise, and officers on their shift would pick out toys for their children, horror movies, or porn. Once, when J.R. started selling little plug-in scooters, miniature bikes whose speeds topped out just under the legal limit requiring a license and registration, a police sergeant said he was going to arrest him for aiding and abetting drug dealers at Cabrini Green. He accused J.R. of giving criminals the means to zip away from the police.
It was exactly the sort of slow-pitch softball comment that J.R. couldn't help but swing at. "Do you even read a book?" he'd shout at the cop, loud enough for the crowds that invariably gathered. He was roused by a sense of indignation, as well as by a need to perform. "Do you have any idea what you're talking about? What about Sammy's Red Hots on Division Street? Sammy sold hot dogs to dope dealers, right? And did the officer know that Mr. Yiros down the block also provided criminals with the sustenance to carry out their illicit activities? Guys in the hood were notorious for shopping at City Sports. Weren't gangbangers using Nikes to run away from the authorities? I'm too smart for you," he'd tell the police officer, mouthing the words with exaggerated slowness. "This one on the plantation learned to read." J.R. and Donna, the mother of his four children, had been on and off for 7 years, and they'd been off for months in 1997 when she felt moved to reconcile after rewatching the Whitney Houston and Angela Bassett movie, Waiting to Exhale. She looked for J.R. and found him in his apartment with someone else. They argued, Donna picking up a fork from the kitchen counter and ramming it into his chest. They were done as a couple. But after a week, he and Donna turned cordial, trying to coordinate as much as they could to raise their children. That's when he was introduced to Aisha. 18, tall and graceful, she had a job in one of the Arab-owned groceries along the mall on Larrabee. J.R. liked that she was work-oriented, like himself, and that she'd been an athlete, also like himself. When they first started dating, the Master P movie I'm Bout It had just released. In no time, J.R. sold out his first 50 pirated copies. By that evening, 100 other people had asked him for the tape. "When something goes viral on the land, in a project thick with people, you could be a millionaire off it," J.R. roared. He bought 10 more VCRs to speed up production. Aisha not only didn't mind holing up in his apartment as he made the VHS copies, but was eager to help. That was a woman for him. Their relationship would end bitterly 10 years later, as Aisha finally, tearfully, came out as a lesbian. In the '90s at Cabrini Green, it was hard to admit you were gay to others, let alone to yourself. But J.R. and Aisha lived happily enough for the time being. "We were the stars of the projects, a hustler and a worker," he would say of their union. "That was my heart." He bought a new Oldsmobile, midnight blue with gold flake paint, and they would drive to Wisconsin or Michigan for the weekend. Once, for Aisha's birthday, he chartered a boat. They were served a candlelit dinner on Lake Michigan as they sailed to Michigan City, Indiana, where Aisha dropped another $800 at the premium outlet stores. "I loved flashing money and helping people out," J.R. would say. He got himself colorful Coogie sweaters and throwback basketball jerseys. He burned through thousands of dollars betting on horses at the nearby off-track parlor, getting fat on the cheese fries. When Aisha gave birth to their first of four children together, they moved into a fifth-floor unit in one of the red high-rises at Cabrini. And there they enjoyed a version of a traditional family life. J.R.'s children would wake him in the morning, clambering atop him with big smiles. They'd sit down for breakfast, drinking orange juice together. He'd walk them to school, only a couple of blocks away. And then J.R. would head off to work, rotating on the dwindling land. Annie Ricks. When Annie Ricks first moved into 660 West Division, a woman who lived on the third floor of the high-rise stopped her. "You're going to be my neighbor," she said. "Yes, ma'am," Ricks replied. It turned out they were related. Over the years, when the elevators weren't working and Annie had to walk up the 5 flights to her apartment, she often popped in at this cousin's place on the third floor and sat for a while at the kitchen table to talk. Then she'd walk up 1 flight and stop again on the 4th floor, where another set of relatives lived. Annie thought about leaving Cabrini Green after a shooting in her building, but it was the third-floor cousin who soothed her. "Baby, stay," she said. "It's going to get better." And it always did. Her son, Deonta, was named the 8th grade valedictorian at Schiller, where the students would still see Jesse White from time to time. "It's Mr. White to you, and Jesse to your mama," he'd say when they shouted his name. Annie's other children won basketball titles and all-tournament honors, and their trophies lined her living room. Her older children found jobs working in construction, retail, and a private residential complex built atop the old Madison Street Skid Row, an area that had been renamed the West Loop. In one of the classrooms in which Annie worked, the teacher surprised her with a pair of earrings as a thank you. Her rent fluctuated from as much as $300 a month when the adults on the lease were all working, to less than $50 a month when they weren't. One Christmas, her son Reggie had his name pulled out of a bag, and he was adopted by the Slick Boys, the rapping cops bringing him gifts for the holidays. When he got older, Reggie would say that Cabrini Green was never as bad as people said. They maintained that it was the most notorious project, but the two big things that people say about it are Dantrell Davis and Girl X, you feel me? They hold on to that. Reggie had gone to school with Girl X, as she was called to protect her identity. In 1997, the 9-year-old girl was attacked on the 6th floor landing of her Cabrini high-rise, just feet from the apartment in which her grandmother had lived for 40 years. She was raped and then choked with a T-shirt, the assailant spraying roach repellent in her mouth and leaving her for dead in a pile of dirty snow. She survived, though she was left blinded, mute, and partially paralyzed. Again, another unimaginable crime at Cabrini Green dominated headlines. And for outsiders, at least, the tenant lawsuit that was holding up development came to seem obscene. "What lifestyle is it that residents want to protect there anyway?" a columnist for the Tribune asked. The city had already invested tens of millions of dollars in public funds into the surrounding blocks for upgraded sewers and utilities, for the widening and repaving of roads. Outside the Rix's home along Division, a 145,000-square-foot shopping center was under construction. Work had also gotten underway on a new library and new police headquarters. Seward Park was renovated, and a manufacturing district was being revived on neighboring Goose Island, with huge tax incentives for companies willing to relocate there. Across the street from Seward Park, the Oscar Mayer factory had closed for good in 1992. After a century in the neighborhood. But in 1997, Old Town Square opened on the site, with 113 new condos and single-family homes. Dan McLean, the well-connected developer of Central Station, Mayor Daley's new home, secured the desirable land and lucrative tax breaks in exchange for setting aside a dozen of the units for CHA families. Eager to settle its lawsuit with residents, city officials tried to assure Cabrini families that the rebuilding in the neighborhood was in their best interest. Weeks after the Girl X assault, the mayor's office held a community meeting at one of the local schools. A special assistant to Daley showed the crowd before and after slides of the plans for the area. "Not a pretty picture. Not much to look at," he said of the before, which for everyone else was both past and present. The after, he promised, would be a complete community. A Cabrini resident cut him off. "A complete community for who?" "They already had a community," people shouted. At another meeting, after the same official invited residents to take part in the planning process, a woman told him that her 49 years on the Near North Side had taught her one thing. "It's always the same. The forums start, then it breaks down," she said. "They'll go behind your back." A Daley official at one of these meetings chastised the crowd for interrupting her before she could deliver prepared remarks. A Cabrini tenant shot back, "You interrupted a way of life, lady." The Coalition to Protect Public Housing was formed in 1996 by Carol Steele, a Cabrini Green resident, and Wardell Yadigan from Rockwell Gardens on the west side. The group hoped to safeguard residents from these dubious development plans, taking as its motto, "Redevelop, don't displace."
The state of public housing might have been deplorable, but the coalition argued that the solution so far didn't look much better. It wasn't about tearing down the bricks and mortar. It was about moving out the people, Steele said. She hosted Saturday workshops and town halls at Cabrini, telling residents about studies that tracked Section 8 families in Chicago and found they were ending up in all-black neighborhoods of concentrated poverty. Many landlords refused to rent to large families with children altogether. And a third of the people given Section 8s were unable to find suitable housing before the vouchers expired. The Jewish Council on Urban Affairs, the Chicago Coalition for the Homeless, the Community Renewal Society, and other civic-minded nonprofits joined the coalition and its fight to preserve affordable housing in the city. A pamphlet the group distributed asked, "If not here," above a photo of a boy standing outside a 7-story red Cabrini high-rise, followed by the question, "Where?" The group's largest action, a people's march to protest public housing policies, took place on June 19, 1997. Juneteenth, the holiday celebrating the day in 1865 when slaves in Texas and other southern states learned belatedly about their freedom. Some 2,000 people gathered outside City Hall and the CHA's downtown offices. Many of them had come to Grant Park just 2 days earlier for the rally celebrating the Bulls' 5th title in 7 years. "This championship goes to all the working people here in the city of Chicago who go out every single day and bust their butts to make a living," Michael Jordan had announced from the stage. For the public housing call to action, there were speeches, performances, and booths to register voters. Those gathered sang an old spiritual that had been used throughout the civil rights era and which took on special meaning when uttered by people fighting to stay in their housing of last resort. "Like a tree that's standing by the water, we shall not be moved." They needed to stand together and demand a more inclusive city. "If you don't plan your community's future," a coalition handout warned, "someone else will." Annie Ricks knew about the meetings and marches. She heard her neighbors talk about the city's schemes to shut down Cabrini Green. She didn't really believe it, though. She pointed to 1230 North Burling, the high-rise across the field from her. The building had new doors and security cameras and 2 elevators that worked. After school most days, Annie brought her students over to play at the building's brand-new playground. "Why would you tear down a building when you just put money into it?" she said. After the Girl X incident, Rick saw that there were more news crews and police officers in the area. But that also felt to her like more of the same. On her way across the parking lot to Schiller School, she was stopped by a cop. He demanded to know where she was going. "Work," she said. "Where are you going?" One day she told Ernest Bryant that she was ready to get married. Although he had never been on her lease, they had 13 children and had been together for a quarter century. "Either you marry me or get out," she said in her half-joking way. "All right, Jeffrey," he agreed. "I'm going to marry you." He called his mother, who said Annie was already her daughter-in-law. They had a big wedding at a banquet hall on the south side, holding the service and reception at the same place so people would have less trouble getting there. Annie's aunt officiated, and her children got drunk. "We had a good time," Rick said. 14. Transformations. In the summer of 1998, officials from HUD called Mayor Daley's office. The federal government had controlled the Chicago Housing Authority since taking it over in 1995, and in those 3 years, by several measures, the agency had improved. Joseph Scholdener, the HUD executive charged with cleaning up the CHA, had previously led the authorities in New York City and Los Angeles. He arrived in Chicago to find Section 8 files packed away neither in chronological nor alphabetical order. No new vouchers were being issued despite 48,000 families languishing on the waiting list, some for more than 20 years. Most of the employees he inherited seemed to be associated in some way with different aldermen or state representatives, and the companies with CHA contracts were almost all politically connected. Everything was political blood sport in Chicago, Schuldiner said of his introduction to the city. He hired a private management company to oversee the voucher program, and he whittled down the CHA staff, eliminating hundreds of jobs. Rather than the housing authority attempting to manage its own properties, or turning to residents to do it themselves, Schuldiner outsourced these duties to private firms at nearly every development. A new system was implemented to track work orders and service requests. For the first time in a decade, an audit showed that the agency's financial records were complete and presented fairly. With these changes in place, the federal government was ready to give the CHA back to the city. The thing was, Daley wasn't sure he wanted it. The mayor was keenly aware that his family name, unfairly and not, was tied to the legacy of public housing in Chicago. Upon sitting down with Schuldiner, Daley read him the minutes from the 1959 U.S. Senate hearing, in which the first Mayor Daley said he didn't want high-risers for his city. Daley wasn't interested in incremental upgrades at the CHA. He didn't believe public housing developments could ever be assets to the neighborhoods around them, and he didn't want to go to Washington with his hands out every year begging for another allowance of Hope 6 funding to make improvements around the edges. If the lawsuits at Henry Horner and Cabrini Green had taught him anything, it was to avoid some piecemeal change, hung up by litigation at every development and then shackled by each ensuing consent decree. The city's public housing projects were monuments to failure in so many different forms, civic and individual, political and historical, physical and economic. Like their place in the city's psyche, their solution needed to be monumental. "Make no little plans," Daniel Burnham had declared about his design for Chicago at the dawn of the 20th century. Daley said he would take back the CHA only if he could tear down all of its high-rises. "This is the end of your political career. You do this. This is impossible," Daley said he was warned. "It's all African-American. You're not going to solve this. Don't do it." Sure, everybody believed that. Leave it as is. But you wouldn't have a city of the future. You'd a city of the past. In September 1999, Daley presented what would be his most sweeping urban renewal program. Under the Plan for Transformation, as the endeavor became known, the city would demolish every remaining public housing family high-rise, knocking down some 18,000 units. Over 10 years, and at an estimated cost of $1.6 billion, Chicago would build public-private mixed-income developments on the cleared land and rehab existing low-rise public housing. The total would add up to 15,000 new or renovated family units, plus an additional 10,000 for senior citizens, reducing the current stock of 38,000 down to 25,000. Daley cast the undertaking as an even more radical transformation of Chicago and its denizens, saying that neighborhoods too long under the pall of towering public housing would finally be imbued with vitality and reconnected to the rest of the city. The very landscape would be remade, the skyline altered, the street grid restored. The replacement housing would be built on a human scale, with only a third of the apartments going to CHA residents, thus breaking up the old concentrations of poverty and triggering further commercial and residential investment. And the mostly black residents who had lived in these neighborhoods in social and economic isolation would now reap the rewards of the prospering city. "I want to rebuild their souls," Daley declared. Julia Stash helped pull together the mayor's public housing transformation strategy, first as Daley's commissioner of housing and then his chief of staff. Discerning and conscientious, she recognized that there was little research into whether families of different economic classes would live amicably side by side in the replacement buildings, or how to manage properties with both private condo owners and public housing renters,
or how exactly the poor would benefit from their close proximity to the gainfully employed, or even what the right mix in these buildings should be, or, more significantly, what would happen to the vast majority of public housing tenants